There we are. So good morning, Professor Kostolits. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've discussed ahead of time, the purpose of this discussion is to go over the period during which spin glass and replica symmetry breaking in particular were formulated from roughly 1975 to 1995. And before we get to that, we have a couple of background questions, if you allow us. So in particular, in your Nobel biography, you mentioned that you started to work with David Thewlis when you joined Birmingham as a postdoc, and that you had given statistical physics relatively little attention before then. What was your impression as a theoretical physicist of statistical physics at that time?
We're talking about the early 1970s.
Yes.
At that time, I didn't sort of understand much of the rigorous statistical mechanics, you know, solutions of eight vertex models and stuff like that. But I was still interested in phase transitions. And so when the renormalization group came along, I decided this looks interesting. And it's probably a way of dealing with this situation in a relatively simple way. Yeah, I actually learned my renormalization group, if you wish, from the papers by Phil Anderson and Gideon Yuval. This was papers written, 1970, 71. And so that was, you know, what I really learned from.
I see. So once you started working with David Thewlis, what guided your problem selection? And how did the two of you work together, if you do?
Oh, it was quite simple. Well, I was originally a high energy theorist, and I was doing long, tedious calculations. And about twice, I was just about to start writing up my calculations for publication when the preprint arrived in my desk, doing exactly what I had done. And so the first time that happened, I just sort of threw my hands up and said, okay, these things happen. And then I started a new problem. Then just again, the same thing happened again. And this, the work was being done by a group at Berkeley. And I decided there's no way I could compete with a group, you know, several people. While I was just stuck in this little office in Birmingham by myself, and so just no way I could compete. So I just started walking around the department, asking everybody I found, do you have a problem that maybe I could look at? And the answer was consistently no, until I got to David Thewlis' office, and he started talking to me. I was standing there, really not understanding very much. And he was writing things on the board and talking. I got desperate. I got more and more lost as he proceeded. And eventually I said, David, sorry, I have to stop you there. I'm sorry, I am completely lost. Could you please explain, where did the first equation you wrote down, where did that come from? And he turned around, looked at me and said, didn't I tell you that? And I could honestly say, no, you didn't. At which point he said, oh, and then proceeded to give a very clear and coherent explanation. And so I decided that should I have much contact with this man in the future, I'm sure that I will being in the same position, not understanding what he was talking about. So I will just assume that he had done the same thing, he's missed out something important. And so that gave me enough courage to ask the stupid questions. And somehow he seemed to appreciate this, and we got on very well from afterwards. And so we started working together.
So was it mostly that he would come up with problems or you would work on them together? Or what was the Bodhisattva and I?
Yeah, the way it worked, well, he would sort of, he was interested in the problem of phase transitions in two dimensions, because, you know, there was this conflict between these rigorous or almost rigorous mathematical statements, you know, things like the Mermann-Wagner theorem, which says that there's no long-range order in systems, two-dimensional systems with a continuous symmetry. And therefore, according to the lore of the that was existing in the early 1970s, there could be no phase transition, because a low temperature phase had to have long range order. And therefore, the Mermann-Wagner theorem seemed to exclude a phase transition in these systems, like, you know, XY model or Heisenberg, two-dimensional XY and Heisenberg models in two dimensions. And it all seemed very reasonable, but then David pointed out this experimental data on superfluid helium films, which, you know, that's a system which is, you know, a two-dimensional system with continuous symmetry, short-range interactions, etc. So that system should not have a phase transition according to the mathematical theorems, but it clearly did have, you know, the data just said, look, there's a phase transition. And so David said, okay, this needs some explanation. You know, what's going on here? And so that was the start of a collaboration. And eventually we sort of, you know, decided that, okay, the essential thing which will destroy superfluidity. Okay, we started off with the assumption we have a two-dimensional system, superfluid system. And we asked the question, what sort of excitations will destroy this superfluidity? And the only thing that can destroy superfluidity are, you know, vortices. So the local excitations do nothing. And so this, the vortices interact logarithmically in two dimensions. So this was obviously the system to look at, was a set of point particles interacting logarithmically, you know, in two dimensions. And so that was the start of everything.
So how, in that context, right, how did you first hear about spin glasses and in what context?
Well, Thallus is also very interested in these random systems. He was working a lot on localization and on spin glasses. And so I got intrigued by spin glasses. So I started trying to understand the literature and basically understand what was going on. Not very successfully.
Do you have any insight into where David Thallus's interest in those models or his problems came from?
David was a funny sort of person, because I have to remember that Thallus was I would classify him as a genius, you know, on the same level as Feynman, Schwinger, and so on and so forth. And so David was always intrigued by unusual problems, you know, things which seem to contradict. He was interested, you know, if you had, you know, contradictions, like the contradiction, apparent contradiction in theory and experiment. Stuff like that always fascinated him. And he, you know, it's just something, it needed an answer. And Dowlais was the sort of person who had a very, you know, flexible mind and could see through, really understood the physics, understood all the, you know, the standard wisdom, and could immediately pick on anything that was wrong. And so he was an amazing person to talk to, because he would always focus on the essential points and just sort of discard all the, you know, any of the trivial, unimportant points. He could identify those instantly. And it was just an incredible experience talking to him and working with him. He would just see through all the garbage and, you know, fluff, and straight to the essential points. And so it was quite an experience.
So can you walk us through the genesis of your first work on spin glasses, which was about the spherical model? How did you get, say, from the SK and the Edwards Anderson proposal to that?
Okay. So these random systems were clearly, Thales is also interested in that. And so these are a problem which was important and extremely difficult. And there's really nothing known about it. You know, the what was it called? The Edwards Anderson stuff. Okay, it's looked sort of right, but it was, how do I say? There was, I was the sort of person who liked to see some exactly solvable model. You know, if you have some class of systems, I always wanted to see some silly, trivial, but exactly solvable model seem to contain some of the essential aspects of the physics. You know, things like the spherical model for phase transitions. Okay, it was a nice, simple, soluble model, which at least displayed some of the phenomena of a phase transition. So I thought, well, you know, maybe one could play the same sort of trick for the spin glass system to see if what would happen. Now, it'd be nice if you could solve this problem. At least it would be an exact, you know, give you some sort of exact solution to this very difficult problem. And so it seemed to work quite, you know, but didn't seem to be too difficult. And so, you know, I was quite surprised that, you know, it worked out. But it was, and then of course we, you know, could understand this, the Parisi's replica symmetry business. At least we could follow the steps that Parisi did, but it didn't, to me, it didn't, just didn't make any sense, because it was mathematically completely illegal and didn't seem to make much sense.
So we will get to the Parisi solution. I wanted to talk a bit more about the pre-Parisi period a bit more, if you don't mind. So if I understand correctly, this idea of the spherical model was largely driven by your curiosity and interest in this. So so David Thales's interest was in disordered system, but this particular approach was your spin on it, to put it.
Well, it just seemed that Since the spherical limit gave you a solution to the standard ordinary phase transition problem, maybe it might work for the spin glass too. So we tried it, and it seemed to make some sort of sense.
So what was the reaction to that work from the community or from your peers?
Not much.
Okay.
No, because basically people were more interested in, the Ising spin glass, because it was a more realistic model, et cetera, et cetera. The spherical limit was, so far from reality that it had no, it was of no particular interest. And then also, of course, people were very intrigued by the Edwards Anderson model, because that was obviously a more realistic model, but nobody could solve it. It was just basically looking for some sort of doable model. To me, it was more that the system was so complicated that it was clear that any realistic model was it's completely insoluble. So maybe it was worth looking for a toy model.
So maybe related to this idea of looking for solvable cases, in statistical mechanics, people have used at least two different approaches. So one is the idea of sending the dimension of space to infinity and then start by solving the mean field and then doing some renormalization group or some loop expansion looking for the upper critical dimension and so on. And the other is to send the number of spin components to infinity and so to do some kind of 1/n expansion. So you worked quite a lot on the 1/n expansion in disordered systems and in spin glasses. But in the recent literature, people have been mostly looking at high 1/d, let's say, expansion. So do you have any insight on why the 1/n expansion has been abandoned in the 80s?
I suppose that I don't really have any insight. Guess I would have is that the 1/n expansion was in for spin glasses was incredibly difficult. I mean, the 1/n expansion, even for relatively simple situations, for a uniform system, the 1/n expansion is, to say the least, a little bit tedious. And so for the spin glass problem, it was just so tedious as to be almost impossible. And anyway, these sorts of expansions, they have to start from, they're an expansion about some soluble model. But at the time, for a uniform system, the n goes to infinity limit is a soluble problem. It's basically the spherical model. But for the spin glass system, that didn't exist. That solution didn't really exist. Even if it did, the 1/n, even if you could formulate a 1/n expansion, it wouldn't really get you very far, because even for a, a real system, it's not a very good approximation. So anyway, it was simply algebraically too hard for me to do this 1/n expansion.
Thank you. In your Nobel biography, also you mentioned that your MS diagnosis in 1978 deeply affected your research choices and productivity for a few years after that. Sure. Was there in particular an impact on your study of spinning glasses, or?
Well, it's basically impacted everything because, okay. At the time, I was living a double life because half my life was spent in the mountains and half in physics. And at the time, the mountaineering part for me was more important, but the physics part, at least I enjoyed it more. And then with the multiple sclerosis, I had to give up, the climbing because, my balance had gone. And, basically it was like I had to basically give up half my life. And that was not an easy thing to do. And so I went into a bit of a depression for a while eventually I came out of it and decided, well, okay, at least I've got the physics half of my life left. And so I'll have to concentrate on that. Certainly this diagnosis affected things quite badly. Basically I lost interest in most things, but since, I had to, keep my job, if you wish, I continue working in physics.
So at about that same period, there were a few proposals for replica symmetry breaking that were popping up from different circles. What was your impression of those ideas, or did you have any in a pre-Parisi context?
I had no thoughts about replica symmetry breaking. I mean, the replica trick was one thing, but the replica symmetry breaking, that was, to me, was just a step too far, if you like, because I could follow the mathematics, but none of the mathematics made sense, if you see what I mean. Didn't connect with reality. And so I never liked that.
So is that also your impression of the Parisi proposal? So including the Parisi ansatz?
But I could swallow, using the n goes to zero limit as a way of averaging a free energy. But that was as far as my as far as I could really swallow it. Just beyond that, the mathematics seemed to have absolutely no justification whatsoever. And so as the replica symmetry breaking, when you start breaking replica symmetry, it's getting further and further from any reality that I just couldn't really swallow it.
So in 1980, you published with David Tallis, shortly after you left Birmingham, a paper on the stability analysis of the Parisi solution.
Yeah.
So how did that come about then, if you were so skeptical of the Parisi ansatz?
It was still worth looking at, still worthwhile looking at whether that solution could have make any sense. Mm. If it's the stability analysis and stuff. I wasn't saying that it was wrong. All I was saying was, couldn't swallow it,
So did you know of Giorgio Parisi before that came about? And
no, but I met him later.
Okay. So how did you find out about his solution? Through the literature or the grapevine or?
It was I can't really remember. I think it was through David Fowler's, you know, Parisi sent him the preprint or something, and David showed it to me, and so I think that's how I found out about it. Then I tried to understand it and failed.
So once you moved to Brown, just a couple of years later, your first PhD student there, I think, Anuradha Janagatan, worked on a random anisotropy model, which has a spin glass phase.
Right.
What led you to study this particular spin glass model or problem?
Just seemed like one of these random problems, you know, problems with randomness that may be possible. That's all. Because, you know, at the time, I decided that, you know, trying to formulate some realistic model of randomness was just ridiculous, because it would be far too complicated to do anything with. And so any, you know, any way of introducing randomness to any model was worthwhile following up, see what would happen. So that's why we looked at this particular thing. Excuse me. My stupid cell phones.
So interestingly, at about that time, right, or shortly after that, you start doing numerical work. So you transition in a sense from exactly solvable model to numerically solvable model. What guided that decision, that transition? And had you paid much attention to numerical work before then?
No, I paid no attention to it at all. Basically, because I've never learned to code. And also, when I was a graduate student at Oxford, I was sitting in an office with about, you know, three or four other graduate students. We're all doing high energy physics. But the other graduate students were all heavily involved in computation. And so I noticed that they were sort of running around as time went on, you know, getting nearer and nearer thesis time. They were running around more and more, getting paler and paler. And I said, no, do a little bit of numerical work, and decided that coding was just too horrendous to even contemplate. And so I decided, no, it's not for me. But then later on, of course, I realized that all physics problems, okay, it's all very well to formulate it, but once you formulate it, they're all too difficult to do anything with analytically, or at least almost all of them. And so of necessity, I decided, okay, since I can't do it analytically, if I want to understand something about this system, I've got to do it numerically. And then I discovered that graduate students in the States, most of them were very good at coding. So it was a natural step to take.
So did you ever code yourself in that context, or it was always your students' work?
I tried to do some coding myself, and then I had this episode where I'd written some code, basically calculating some integral numerically, and the machine spat out a number which looked perfectly reasonable. And then I discovered this number was actually wrong. You know, it's like the difference between, you know, 4 and 6, right? The correct answer was 6, but the computer was spitting out 4. And I could not understand, you know, it took forever to find the place where the error was. You see, it all was that I wrote the code, put it on the machine, and it ran immediately. I thought, oh, I'm wonderful, I'm an expert. And then it spat out this number, which turned out to be wrong. Then it took me ages to track down the mistake. Then I just thought, this is just, it's ridiculous. I can write the piece of code which looked perfectly good, but it's not right. And then the machine, but then the stupid machine spits out a number. You know, because I had previously had the impression that if you made a mistake in the coding, the program just wouldn't run. And then I discovered to my horror, this wasn't quite true. It could run and spit out a number which looked right, but it wasn't. Then there was another episode of coding when I was doing some trying to write code for some statistical mechanics. And the code ran, but the answer didn't look right. And so I sort of basically simplified the code to a point where the problem is completely trivial. I could actually follow every step mentally. And then I ran it and it didn't work again. Spat out a completely wrong number. So I thought, what the hell's going on? Then we discovered that for some reason, at one point, we declared an array size to be 64. And I just thought, well, let's just change this number 64 to 65, see what happens. And it ran and seemed to be perfectly correct. So then we discovered that if we put in any array size, which is 2 to the n, something went wrong. Then eventually we discovered that there was a bug in the compiler. So we wrote an angry letter, which is an IBM desktop. We wrote an angry letter to IBM complaining about this bug in their compiler. And then we got back a letter to the effect that this was a non-fatal bug and was really of no interest. And you know, the amount of time we'd spent in tracking down this bug was just unbelievable. But to get this letter saying that it's a non-fatal bug, just of no interest, just drove me crazy. And so from then on, I decided it's just not worth the effort. Coding is just not worth the effort. And so now I've got the point that graduate students do the coding.
So getting back to spin glasses, after Arunada's thesis, you didn't really work on spin glasses for the better part of a decade. Did you stay in touch with the spin glass community during that time? And if yes, how?
Just following the literature. And you know, it just seemed that people weren't really getting anywhere. It's like a lot of difficult problems. I always have what seems to happen is that there's a lot of very smart people. The only trouble is that all these people are basically doing exactly the same thing. And they're all getting to some point. And then they're not making any more progress. They're all just going round and round in circles, producing papers and stuff, which actually isn't going anywhere. then it just seemed to me that the only way of making any progress in fields like this is for somebody to come from, you know, some ignorant fool coming from left field and just saying, okay, let's forget about the standard wisdom. Let's see if we can, you know, do something else. And sometimes this succeeds and mostly doesn't.
So in the mid-90s, you did return to the study of spinning glasses using numerics, right? So what made you think that this was potentially one of those interesting approaches?
Well, it seemed to be that it was possible to, you know, to construct it was when, you know, after I'd done the two-dimensional planar rotor model I was talking about, the topological defects, vortices and stuff. And I thought to myself, look, what in these systems, what seems to happen here is that you can basically the system seems to decompose into a Hamiltonian describing the smooth fluctuations plus another piece describing the interaction between vortices. And the, at least for the two-dimensional planar rotor model, the only important bit is the vortex-vortex interaction, the spin wave, the smooth spin wave part is unimportant. So you can just ignore that. And I thought, well, maybe the same something happens in an XY spin glass or, you know. And so it was possible to write down a problem where the frustration, the analog of the vortices, decoupled from the smooth variations of the phase. And so if you just concentrated on the frustration part, maybe we can do something. Then there was the question, of course, if you're going to do something like finite size scaling, which was seemed to be a pretty powerful way of sort of doing problems, you know, like if you want to figure out whether or not there's an ordered state, you know, a distinct ordered state exists, finite size scaling is a very good way of doing it. You know, like a two-dimensional, d-dimensional uniform model. If you have continuous symmetry, the defect energy or the domain wall energy scales like the system size to the d minus two. If this d minus two changes to something, you know, some other exponent, that exponent is negative. This means that the energy of a defect, you know, and of course these defects, if you have a lot of these defects, that means the system's disordered. It's like the main wall and the magnet. And so if this exponent is positive, then these defects cost too much energy. And so at low temperatures, there won't be any, therefore the presumably it's an ordered phase. But if that stiffness exponent is negative, the energy of a defect when the system gets very big, goes to zero. And we will be there, and this would correspond to no phase transition. This is actually quite a powerful way of doing things. And so the question was, could one actually do this numerically for a random system? Because it's not easy. I mean, most of the people had attempted this before, but they'd been a bit too naive because they just used the method which works for a uniform system by comparing the energy, you know, with periodic boundary conditions versus anti-periodic boundary conditions, you know, in one direction. Now, because this is a ferromagnet that will induce a domain wall. And therefore, if this defect energy increases with system size, clearly there's no phase transition. But of course, for a random system, this starts getting a bit difficult because periodic boundary conditions, anti-periodic boundary conditions are just a pair of boundary, random boundary conditions, because if you have some random interactions and you're looking at a defect. So the question is, what the hell is the ground state? And to find the ground state, you need to apply the correct boundary, find the boundary conditions first. You know, for instance, suppose you take an anti-ferromagnet. If you have an even number of lattice sites in one direction, then the appropriate boundary conditions is to respect the anti-ferromagnetic ground state. Is what is. I can't remember whether it's anti-ferromagnetic. But if you make the number of lattice sites odd in that direction, the appropriate boundary condition is periodic boundary conditions, not anti-periodic. And therefore, for a random system, it's clear that periodic boundary conditions and anti-periodic boundary conditions are just two sets of boundary conditions which don't respect anything in particular. And so if you want to do something analogous to what you do in a uniform system, you'd have to first find the boundary conditions which are consistent with the ordered state. But since you've got randomness, you don't know what the ordered state is, and therefore finding the boundary conditions is a little bit difficult. But we actually managed to, for the XY spread glass, or at least gauge glass, if you wish, managed to exploit this by arguing that the boundary conditions are themselves of some sort of, have to be decided by the structure of the state. Therefore, they have to be part of the simulation. Those boundary conditions have to be determined by, you know, the simulation, as those boundary conditions minimize the energy of a system. And then to induce the defect, you simply change the boundary conditions one direction by, put an extra twist of pi across the system. And that will, so then, the energy with those boundary conditions will be the energy with it of the system with a defect, and therefore that energy is almost by definition larger than the original one, and it had better, you know, if your simulation making any sense at this point, that's a good check to make sure that you actually see that, you know, to change the boundary conditions will actually increase the energy. But, and that was the, you know, the most difficult part of the calculations, to work out what these boundary conditions consistent with the ordered state or the lowest energy state, you know, actually how to impose them. And so that took us a long time to figure out, because we'd stand there at the blackboard arguing and go round and round in circles. But after a month or so of this, we managed to figure out what to do. And so we realized that it was actually possible to put on these boundary conditions. And then make a uniform twist in the phase about those boundary conditions and could calculate the energies relatively easily. But I remember when we first published our first paper in this, and this general reaction of blank, not understanding. Well, which didn't really surprise us. It had taken us about 2 months of, arguing and thinking about nothing else before we could understand what we were doing. But eventually we did understand it, and so our methods seemed to work. You see, it was analogous to, if you think about a ferromagnet, you know that the boundary conditions consist with the ordered state are periodic. And if you want to induce a defect in one direction, you simply flip the boundary conditions in that direction from ferromagnet to antiferromagnet. Simple. But for a random system, it's very different. One still wanted to do the analog of this periodic to antiperiodic. But the analog of the periodic boundary conditions are those boundary conditions minimize the energy. And so one has to, the boundary conditions are determined by, have to be determined by the simulation.
So in your Nobel biography, you mentioned that at about the same time as this work came out, or maybe even following this work, you lost your NSF funding that was associated with Spinning Glass, and that you didn't really understand why that happened. Have you since learned more?
No, I haven't bothered, because I found that I could, work perfectly happily without a grant. And I thought, it's not worth my time applying for grants.
So
even if I did put in the effort to write a grant proposal, well, I did put in the effort once and was turned down again. And so I decided it's just not worth it.
So some have mentioned that a change of program manager at the condensed matter and materials theory group at NSF might have been affecting a change in taste for physics problems. Is that your impression as well?
I have no idea, because I just take the point of view, look, I got to the point where I decided, look, I want to do physics, solve the physics problems which turn me on. Don't care what everyone's doing, because I don't follow the crowd and do what everybody else is doing. I want to solve problems that turn me on. And so since I took that attitude, I decided, look, there's no point in applying for more grants, because after the experience of this, of the, trying to get this grant in random systems, probably the community won't understand what I'm talking about anyway. So what's the point?
So in that context of free exploration of physics, how influential has Spinning Glass research been on your overall efforts in physics, if any?
There hasn't been any particular influence, except in the sense that, okay, physics problems are hard. And so, and you need the people who have new ideas, who are to think outside the standard box. But you know, when you believe things like it's not going to get you grants because the funding agencies want results, and unless you already have results, your proposal will be turned down. It's a proposal that says something like, okay, I want to study this because there are lots of unsolved problems interesting. That doesn't get you funded. What gets you funded is saying, okay, I'm going to do this and this because I will get this result from this, that result from that, and so on and so forth. And obviously you have to do the work basically before you apply for grant. So to me, that's not research, because if you know what the answer is, why bother? You don't need money to solve the problem because you've already solved it. But you have to solve for the, you can write the proposal to get the grant. So in my advanced years, the only conclusion you could come to is, what's the point of wasting 2 or 3 months writing a grant proposal?
So from you having worked both in Europe and the US, do you have any insight as to the difference in perception of replica symmetry breaking between the two physics communities?
Well, let me just say that there was one paper that influence, had a very heavy influence on me, and that was a paper by Daniel Fisher, and I think it was Fisher and Hughes, who basically were not doing any replica symmetry, playing any replica symmetry games at all. And so I was thinking, since we don't know whether this replica symmetry breaking and stuff is, what it does and whether it makes any sense, if you want to look at a short range spin glass or random system with short range interactions, you're better off not trying to use replicas, but just do the simplest, most obvious way of doing the average. In other words, take a set of interactions, calculate the free energy or whatever, and then repeat this over and over again for different realizations of randomness, and then do the averaging. So numerically, this is the obvious thing you do numerically. And that method seems to make a lot more sense. And so that's what I tried to do. It seemed to work. It was just that it made the computations a little bit tedious, shall we say, because repeating the computation many, many times for different sets of randomness is a bit time consuming.
So during your time at Birmingham, at Brown or elsewhere, did you ever teach a class that talked about spin glasses and maybe even replica symmetry breaking?
I think in advanced system mechanics course. I may have touched on it, but in advanced statistical mechanics course, there's so much material that there's barely time to do anything in detail.
So we're approaching the end of our conversation. So is there anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we might have skipped over or neglected?
Not really. It was just that, of course, that era was the period when I was young enough to actually, look at new things and with a bit of luck, actually come up sometimes with, make some progress sometimes. But it was a fun period, but then I think that is just because I was, I was young enough to enjoy myself. It's always been my mantra, especially to young people, and that is, look, you should always do what you like, what you enjoy, and have a lot of fun doing it. Otherwise, what's the point of studying what you're studying? If you're not having fun doing it, don't do it.
So do you have any notes, papers, or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
To tell the honest truth, no, because my method of keeping notes was just to write it on bits of paper. And then those bits of paper would gradually disappear, would sit in a pile and gradually disappear. So I don't actually have any handwritten notes of that, of anything.
Well,
the only way that I tend to keep things is, if I type something on the computer, so it lasts as long as the computer memory lasts.
Professor Kostelitz, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.